Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Jimmy C. from the Saturday Night Speakers Group of Eastern PA.
Hi, everybody. I'm Jim Crossan. I'm a recovered alcoholic. Hi, everybody, and certainly really grateful to be here. Thank you to Jeff and to the group for having me. You often hear speakers say from the podium they can never repay the debt that Alcoholics Anonymous has given them for the life they have. It's been a real interesting 2012, and let me say happy 2013 to everybody that's in the room tonight. But 2012 has been a very interesting year for me, and it's been a year of really seeking and really trying to understand my relationship with a power greater than myself. And one thing I know is one of the things I've been allotted through the principles and the steps of this program and doing the footwork to the best of my ability is I'm the freest I've ever been in life. I don't think I have a God that wants me to feel like I'm in debt to Alcoholics Anonymous, to be honest with you. I think he wants me to respect it. I think he wants me to talk about it with honor, integrity, and dignity. I think he wants to make sure that when I'm in the rooms, I'm the best member of Alcoholics Anonymous I can be, which means that I need to be really practicing that number one principle, and that's honesty. And it's funny because I came over to say hello to Jim, and I said, good to see you here, Jim. And Jim said, well, I just came to make sure you're going to be honest tonight, Jim. So there's that principle, that honesty principle, And, I want to thank my friend Kathy who came up with me tonight. I'm really glad she called today. I'd sponsored Kathy and had taken her to the work, and life had kind of taken us different ways, and we don't talk to each other as much as we can. She called today, and she was talking about staying home, and here we are at the meeting together. We listened to a wonderful speaker CD on the way up of someone who I heard at the Liberty Bell Roundup last summer, and this lady just unraveled my heart when she talked, to the point where, near the end, just tears were flowing out of my eyes, and I was so baffled of what was happening. I was like, I couldn't understand why. The more she talked, the more it's like I couldn't handle my emotions. After the meeting, I went and talked to the young lady, experienced member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said to me that, she really believed that after I explained to her what I was going through, that God put her on her plane and brought her here for me to hear her, and that I was supposed to come up and have that conversation with her after the meeting, that she clearly knew that she touched somebody. That's what this last year has really been about for me. It's really, really been about opening my heart up, having some humbling experiences, understanding with a little more depth and weight what my relationship with God is like and my purpose in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I think back, I haven't picked up a drink since August the 20th, 1998. That is my sober date. I can't say I picked it. It kind of picked me. All I know is on August the 19th, I was in a vehicle driving by a house that I couldn't go to because I had warrants out for me. And when I drove by it, the cops were standing on my porch, and they were talking to my neighbors, and my neighbors see me in a car and pointed at me. And you just can't seem to outrun the two-way radio these days, because I was trying. And a little Subaru, and eventually they stopped me and pulled me out of the car and asked me who I was, and I proceeded to tell them I was a gentleman who was 6'2", was born on a different day than I was. He has brown eyes. I have brown eyes. My stepbrother, I told him I was, and they weren't buying it, and they gave me a choice. And for me, sometimes when you give me a choice, I still think I have room to wiggle. And they said to me, you could either get in the car with handcuffs or without handcuffs. To me, I was a biggie. In the car without handcuffs, man, I might have a move left, So I decided I'm going to get, either way, I'm getting in the car, they tell me. So I'm like, all right, well, I'm getting in the car, so I might as well get in without handcuffs. And I don't know where they're taking me. They're not telling me. And they go and they drive in front of my house And they get out, and they knock on all my neighbors' doors and bring them all out around the car. And they're going, is this so-and-so? Is this so-and-so? And all my neighbors are going like this, and I'm in the car going like this. And there was this calamity that was going on. I call it calamity. It was calamity. It seemed like there was a million conversations going on, and I wasn't a part of them. I was just basically listening to them all, and I had something on this shoulder going, it's finally over, man. Just go to jail, Jim. You got a shot at maybe getting better again. Stop the suffering. And then on this shoulder, it was like, kick the window out, dude. If you get out the window, you don't have any handcuffs. They won't get. And this battle's going on, man. And I'm like in the middle, like a tennis match. You know what I mean? I just think about that insanity. Just that full-time job with unlimited overtime of what it took on a daily basis to just be killing myself, man. You know, couldn't even attach any words like fun or joyful or anything to it. It was pure suffering. You know? Hopeless. That hopeless state of mind and body. You know? And, my life isn't like that today at all. Not at all. While I still experience a lot of those feelings, I've always had in life, I don't react in any way, shape, or form like I used to react to them. Certainly not using the drink as a solution to any of them. You know, and for me, that's really huge, because if I keep that drink away, I stand a chance of what I need to be doing in this program to, you know, truly understand that life is going to be life. And, I have a set of tools and principles that I can enforce, which can deepen my relationship with God. That's what I've really found out probably over the last 14 and a half years, is as I'm able to walk through life and not react the way I used to react and keep suiting up and showing up and following those directions, that my relationship with God gets closer through all the trials and tribulations and the low spots and the peaks, you know. As I told you, my sobriety date was August the 20th of 1998. That was not the first time I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. First time I was in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was in 1978, which is a pretty long time ago. And I'm here to clearly tell you that I did not wake up on that day thinking I had a problem with alcohol and that I would go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to see what was up. Nothing like that happened. As a matter of fact, I was in Bucks County Prison, and another inmate popped his head in my cell and told me there was free donuts and free coffee in the cafeteria, and I thought it was a great idea to go over there and get some free donuts and free coffee, and I got a plan together very quickly of what I was going to do, and I was going to go over there, and I was going to get as many donuts as I could. I was going to get a big cup of coffee. I was going to go back to my cell. I was going to turn on a movie. I was going to lay in my bunk. I was going to eat those donuts and get crumbs all over my chest and have the best damn day in jail I've ever had. That was my plan. Well, I got over there, and my plan didn't go like my plan was going. And you know what? Something about my plans and ideas, and I've come to notice this through a lot of things I've done in life, is I'll begin to implement a plan, and it'll begin to work to the point where I can take this right hand and throw it over my left shoulder and go, you're good. You got this. Right when that happens, somebody seems to pull this carpet out from underneath my feet and let me know that your plans don't work very good, Jim. And that happened that day at that cafeteria. Because I went over there and I got three donuts in the right pocket, three donuts in the left pocket. I had one in the hand. I had a huge cup of coffee. I was headed to go back out that cafeteria gate to go back to my cell, and a guy with a uniform popped in front of me. And I will assure you there have been a lot of guys with uniforms in my story. And he's like, where are you going? I'm like, back to my cell. And he's like, no, I have to go sit in that back row over there. And I'm like, why? And he goes, you have to stay for the meeting. I'm like, meeting? What meeting? He said, the AA meeting. And I said, what's an AA meeting? And he's like, just kind of looked at me and shook his head, like a lot of people have done in life. That look, you know, you get that look and they kind of shake your head like you're a clueless dude, you know. And he pointed to the back. He said, don't make any noise. It's going to be an hour long. And you go back to your cell, do whatever you want. And I can remember clearly this feeling. I couldn't identify it because I was nowhere near being able to identify feelings for the longest time. But this feeling came up from my stomach into my chest, into my neck, into my head, scrambled my thinking, became very panicked. I realized this isn't going my way. These donuts and coffee are not free. There's a price to pay. I have to sit in something that I don't know what I'm about to sit in. I look at the guy next to me. I automatically blame him. I'm getting ready to punch him out because it's his fault now that he got me in this dilemma. And I go and I sit in the back row of that chair, very disgruntled, probably practiced every character defect that was in my four-step in that hour, judgmental, prejudice, you know, all those things. And I remember some older gentlemen walking into the cafeteria, sitting down, talking among themselves, and all of a sudden they open this meeting up. And they began to do something we would call qualify. And I can remember, I looked at the guy next to me and I said, "What losers? Who would come into a jail and talk about this kind of stuff? Are you kidding me?" And I can remember, like, I was having the worst experience in that hour that I perceived I was ever going to have in my life. It was actually, like, punishing, it seemed. And finally, I got some relief. I was looking for relief. I got it. The gentleman said, "Now we're going to close the meeting." I was like, "Thank God." And I can remember I got up and I turned around and I ran through that door and that guy with that uniform popped out. He's kind of pointing, and I don't know what he's pointing at because I have my back to everything. And finally, I turn around, and everybody's standing in a circle. And I think, oh, I need to go stand in the circle, and this will be over. So I go, and on my way to the circle, I notice something that really bothers me. I notice everybody's holding everybody's hands. And guys don't hold guys' hands in jail. That is like a no-no. You know what I mean? So I kind of roll over there, and I don't know what to make of all this. I'm very uncomfortable. I kind of throw the pinkies out. You know what I mean? Don't touch them. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. And all of a sudden, they begin to say the Lord's Prayer, and I don't know it. And my full name is James Joseph Anthony, which means I should probably know the Lord's Prayer a little bit. But I don't know it. So I'm my head down, I'm going, blah, 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 blah. I'm just trying to make it sound like whatever anybody else is saying. And I am so uncomfortable. And I can remember finally they stop, and the guard says, "Now you can go." And I remember going back to my cell and saying to myself, "I will never return to a place like that. Never. Never. I don't care what happens in my life. Anybody ever mentions ANA or whatever, AAA or whatever, it's not happening. No way. Like, I'll go to my grave before I'll go back to a place like that." That was back in 1978. Well, I'm here to report that through my journey, and it's been quite the journey of a lot of rehabs and detoxes and penitentiaries and county jails and parole officers and probation officers, and you name it. I've had every one of them in my life at multiple times. That when they talked about this thing called recovery, or this thing about treating alcoholism, they always pointed me back to this program called ANA. And for the life of me, I could not figure out why these people would give me this death sentence to going to this place that I had the most horrific experience in, and that they just didn't understand what they were doing, and they were setting me up for more problems. But yet, time after time, you got to go to AA. You have to go to AA. Get a parole officer. Got to make sure you go to meetings, this many meetings a week. So I kept getting sent to this place. So I would be in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am here to say that, and I don't know if this is so or not. I'm only going to tell you my perception. My perception is when I would run in and out of these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, I heard them talking about the physical big book as though you need to have a big book. But I never really heard anybody really talking about the big book or really like breaking down their experience with the big book. Right? Maybe they were and I didn't hear it, but I don't recall it. I just remember a couple key things as I would run in these rooms. They would say, "You need to take a commitment. You need to get a sponsor. You need to have a home group." And then it would kind of end there. So I would follow those rules. And I would go help set up the meeting. And I would make some coffee. And I would get a sponsor. But I'd always look for the sponsor who had a lot of time. And not as far as time to give me, but time so that I could tell them I have this sponsor and he has as much time as though it's going to make me a whole lot better. And if I called that sponsor, Once a year, he was lucky, let alone twice a year. I would see him in meetings. He'd ask me how I was doing, you know, different things. And you know, I was kind of going through the motions in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I basically was coming here because they told me I had to come here. You know, I'd eat your cookies, drink your coffee. If I was lucky, date your girls, which I was always trying to do. Was really running amok about who I was as a person with untreated alcoholism. Now, I can tell you clearly that I really struggled with this being an alcoholic thing. And I think the reason I really struggle with it so much is because it's not a lot of grandiosity attached to identifying yourself as an alcoholic. You know, our book talks about that alcoholic with the grandiose behavior and inferiority complex. That's me to a T. I'm the guy that when I present myself to you, I present myself to you in a way where I'm going to try to get you to like me so much or think so highly of me that you couldn't possibly see behind that all as this scared little boy that really does not know how to show up in life, doesn't know anything about life, is totally scared to death that if you really get to know me, you won't like me, you'll hurt me. I mean, behind all that is this guy, but yet what I present to you is I'm a legend in my own mind. I accomplished this, 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 and this, you know. And these are the kind of things going on, and I don't know where this stuff has come from. All I know is it's habitual now. It's not even a guess. It's like it's become a part of my everyday life that this is what I suit up and show up and do every day. And I have no understanding that it's my untreated alcoholism. I just think it's me. I just think it's who I am. It's every fiber of my being. So, as I run out of, in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I keep having these bouts of stopping. See, I've stopped a lot of times. You know, stopping was never my problem. There's been so many marvelous interventions out there that have been performed on me that have gotten me to stop. You know, most of them have come in the form of handcuffs and jail cells and cop cars and all that stuff, but they've also come in trying to get my kids to talk to me again. They've come in not wanting to lose the girlfriend. They've come in mom and dad will talk to me and enable me a little more. They've come in all forms, these interventions, and I would stop for a period of time. But I could never stay stopped. And for life of me, that was not a question that I was even really willing to look at, even though I knew it was real. Even though I knew as I got into my 20s and I'd gotten out of a penitentiary that it was absolutely insane to pick up a drink again and other things, because for me the drink bone's connected to the drug bone. They go together. You know, in my life I never really thought alcohol could take me where I wanted to go. Not that I knew where I was going by any means. But I would drink to a point where I'd get primed enough to start making those other moves with courage, going to those places I wouldn't normally go, behaving in those ways I wouldn't normally behave, you know, crossing those lines that I knew were morally wrong to cross. If I get enough alcohol in me, those lines became invisible, and I gave myself permission to go interact on levels that I knew weren't morally right. And, you know, all those situations would lead me to jails and institutions. You know, three things are usually happening with me when I pick up a drink. One is I'm thinking about committing a crime. Second thing is I'm committing that crime. And the third thing is the police are chasing me for committing that crime. There is no such thing as probation or parole once I pick up a drink. It does not exist. I don't give urine tests. I don't show up. I don't do any of that. It turns completely into catch me if you can. You know, and I know that I'm on this run where I'm on the move with my head on a swivel 24/7, just waiting for that intervening moment when me and the police arrive at each other's eyes and they start asking questions that I don't have answers to. And I lived my life like this for a long time. And the insanity of it is very crazy. But I'm not willing to take a look at the fact that the drink and other things have anything to do with it. Even though I'm in and out of detoxes and rehabs, and even though I have people trying to tell me that the thing that's always present through all my situations, the common bond is always alcohol and other things, I think they're crazy. Because I don't want to be alcoholic. I don't want to be alcoholic. I loved my other titles. I love when you call me a burglar, a drug dealer. I can attach great stories to that stuff. I got this much out of this house. That bag was this big. You know, I stole this kind of car. You know, when it came to saying I'm alcoholic, I just didn't have a great story to attach to. It seemed like it was bottom of the barrel. No room left underneath the belly to move. So, and I think another reason why I didn't want to be alcoholic is because I knew that there was a label that was attached to my father. My father was alcoholic. He was the doctor in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde they talk about in the book. He was that guy. I didn't know that then. I was pretty confused about his behavior back then when I was little, but I know clearly today when I got an understanding of what untreated alcoholism is, and they talked about the Jekyll and Hyde in the book, I'm like, that's my dad to a T. Because he was the kind of guy who, in the morning, he would be like, Dad, man, playing with you, wrestling with you, laughing, you know, everything was great, man. Like, and then all of a sudden, the clock would hit this certain time, and he'd have this psychic change, man. It's like, where did Dad go? It's like, I didn't exist to the rack, put the coat on, leave the house, wouldn't see him most of the day, most of the night. And all of a sudden, it seemed like right about when I was getting ready to go to bed or I'd already be sleeping on the couch or something like that, the door would come flying open and there would be a man standing in that doorway, and he was not the man that was playing with me in the morning. Smelled different, looked different, sounded different, and certainly acted different. And, you know, I think about, when I look back, because they say hindsight's 20/20, I think about how methodical he was with his untreated alcoholism. Very methodical in his behaviors, especially in relation to my mother. Because my mother's like 4'11", but when my dad would come home drunk, I don't know how she did it, she would come 6'2", pointing in his chest, you know, just really giving him hell. And he would go through this method of, first he would kind of push her aside and try to walk through the house, and she'd pop back in front of him, and then he would kind of throw a piece of furniture, and that wouldn't stop her, and then he'd kind of push her to the ground, and it was very, like, every time, like, this pattern of it. So I remember I used to experience this feeling when this was going on that I didn't know why I thought I knew what was going to happen. I knew it was going to get progressively ugly. So my favorite place was under the bed in the house. I would go under the bed. And the amazing part about it is as much as I would want to run and get under that bed, I would still want to crawl to the edge of that bed and peep or hear exactly what was going on, even though I kind of knew what was going to go on. Just how bad was it going to get? Was it going to stop? Now, is that what makes me alcoholic? I don't, by any means, I don't. Not at all, but I can certainly tell you that when I really sat down and did some really good four-step work and was really able to track back through a lot of the ways that I interacted in my environment and a lot of ways I perceived things and some of the things that I got into in life before I long picked up a drink, my dad's untreated alcoholism had a major effect on me. It really did. You know, I can remember I would step outside of my house into my environment with my friends and everything, and, you know, automatically I thought they looked at me different. You know, I would compare my insides with their outsides, you know. I would compare what was going on in my house with what their family was like. I mean, I had to become an habitual liar so that I could feel like I was keeping up with the Joneses when they would talk about their family, you know. People would say, oh, me and my dad did this. I'd be like, oh, yeah, me and my dad did that. Or, oh, yeah, we're going to do that, and my family's going to do this. And none of it was a reality. And it seemed like that behavior, even though I wasn't drinking, became progressive in nature. Because not only would I tell you something to kind of even up with the Joneses, I became real comfortable with putting a couple exclamation points after it. Like, it may be even better than your story. Because that's how good my family is. We don't just do what you do. We put a little icing on the cake. Don't you know who we are? And the reality is that my big thing that I was pretty much hoping wouldn't happen is everybody wouldn't get together and really talk about it and figure out what a big liar I was, and that none of you would really like me. So, you know, in our book after that third step, it talks about that actor. You know, I was putting that act on long before I picked up a drink. You know, varied traits, creating more confusion and harmony. You know, just people kind of knew what I was doing. You know, I would be out there committing this behavior to be liked and putting people in a position not to like me. You know, and probably at about 12 or 13 years old, I was in a situation and the planets kind of aligned and somebody popped that top and handed me that beer and I put it to my lips and I had an experience like I never had before. That stuff wasn't even in my thought process when I drank. I couldn't really care what you thought about me. You hear a lot of people say they kind of feel like those people should have been damn lucky to be hanging out with me. I kind of feel the same way. You know, and the reality is that, you know, I had this experience where I was able to do things that I was never able to do before. You know, I could say things to females, ask them out, dance around parties. It's like, just seems like my spirit came out of me. The spirit that I was never able to touch. You know, they talk about that spiritual malady, that spiritual disconnection. Man, I had that big time long before I picked up a drink. I was so disconnected, it was unbelievable. I took a drink, I felt connected. There's always one thing I've always hated about alcohol and drugs, though. And that is they always wear off. And I got to go back to that disconnected feeling. Mm-hmm. And there's a major indifference between me and you. We can't connect. I'm not there. I got too much stuff blocking me from allowing that to happen because I'm too worried about what you think about me and what my next move needs to be so you like me. And I have all this stuff that keeps me so disconnected with self. And I take this drink and it seems to solve that problem and it wears off and I got to go back and drink. And I develop this thing called tolerance where I got to drink more and I got to drink more often. And at a very young age, it stops working. And I start to experience a lot of the consequences, the external consequences that go with it. I'm in and out of the juvenile justice system. My parents don't know what to do with me. I'm getting kicked out of schools. All this unmanageability is happening in my life externally. But even bigger, all this unmanageability is happening internally. I'm emotionally shut down. I can't mentally have a good thought process. I'm physically just killing myself by all the booze and everything I'm putting in me. So I'm really working this thing inside and out. It's killing me from both ends. And I'm starting to experience a lot of consequences that go along with it. And people are telling me things like, you need to get help. And I don't think I need help. I'm telling them they're crazy. I'm fine. You know, my world is falling down around me, and I tell people they're seeing things. Go make an eye doctor's appointment. You're seeing it all wrong. It's not happening like that. You know, and at 18, my parents, my mom and my stepdad have that tough love conversation with me. You can't be here anymore. We don't trust you. You're violent. You steal from us. We come home. You come home 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. We come downstairs. Cigarettes burning in the carpet. You're going to burn the house down. Just throw up all. I mean, you just can't be here. There's nothing about you that's remotely attractive about you being here. We love you as a son, but this can't happen. And I have no place to go. And you know what? I was talking about this yesterday. I spoke at a rehab up in Wilkes-Barre yesterday, and the families come in on Sundays. And I can so much relate to how much this problem affects not only the alcoholic, but the ripple effect of the family. Because if you think within our untreated alcoholism we could come up with some pretty good plans and ideas, you should see what a family member can come up with their plans and ideas when they're affected by untreated alcoholism. Because my mom, clear as day, looked at me in the eyes with all the sanity in the world and said something to me that is so insane, and it sounded like such a great idea, and actually followed the plan. And she looked at me at 18 years old with no place to go, but she telling me that I couldn't be there anymore and looked at me and said, you know what? I know it's a good idea. Why don't you go move with your real father? The guy you hid under the bed from. In so many words. And at that time, I realized how much my father loved his drinking. And you know what? The way I saw it was, you know, I think that's going to work because me and my dad have something in common. So I said, okay, call him up. And he was more than willing to come up and pick me up because this is his chance to make everything okay with his kid that he hasn't been there for in many, many years because of his untreated alcoholism. I would love to tell you we were father and son, but I'd be lying to you. I mean, the reality is we were drinking buddies, drugging buddies, violent buddies, crime buddies, and eventually do time in the same cell buddies. And I can remember My pride and ego grabbed that moment when we were in jail together as though we were, like, really accomplishing something together. Like, me and Pops, man. You know what I mean? And what happens is I'm in jail with a bunch of other sick people, so they begin to support this idea, and they give us nicknames, and they call us Augie Doggie and Doggie Daddy. We have arrived. You know what I mean? Don't you know who we are? We are Augie Doggie and Doggie Daddy. Oh, my God. You know, I think of the insanity of that and how I wrote that, and it just seemed like it made all the sense in the world, and I was kind of... You know, the reality is... You know, when I did the work, I looked at two common themes in my life that kind of went along with my untreated alcoholism. One was alcohol was always present, and two was my dad was always present. So one of the things I had to do was I really needed to kind of put my dad out of my life for a piece so I could get somewheres and really begin to take a look at what my untreated alcoholism was about. And... You know, that didn't happen until 38 years of age. You know, as I told you about that date, August the 19th, I wound up in jail. They wound up taking me to jail that night. And, you know, I remember sitting in that jailhouse, that jail cell by myself, and I began to have conversations with myself like I've never had before. And they weren't conversations of my next plans and ideas as much as they were conversations of desperation. They were really conversations of, you know what, Jim? You're either going to jail for a really, really long time, or you just better start asking. You just better start begging that someone touch your life and give you another shot. Because I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a stretch without picking up a drink for about almost 10 years previously. Now, if you ask me what I was doing in AA for that 10 years, it describes it in our 12 and 12. It's called two-stepping. Hi, my name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic. How can I help you? It's pretty much how I was living my life. See, I'd learned about service, and that's about all I learned. I really didn't learn a lot about unity. I really didn't learn a lot about recovery because even though I had a sponsor, I wasn't working any steps. Did I know I was an alcoholic at that time? I knew the problem was alcohol at that time. I knew that. I correlated that when I pick up a drink, my life becomes unmanageable. I could get there. But I had to go to step 12 automatically because I really believe that if I could help you and you could tell me that how much I'm helping you, I could feel real good about myself. See, I still had that problem of this right hand liking to go up over my left shoulder and pat myself on the back and tell myself what a good job I do. And if you can confirm that, I felt like I was good. And the reality is that, you know, I'm a bottom of the barrel drunk. So when I put down the drink, my life gets so greatly better than it was that I think everything's good. See, I have no understanding or no clue of what the real integral parts of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous are about because I've rested my laurels after I put the drink down because things are getting better. Gaining some weight, getting some color back. People are telling me I'm looking good. Mom and Dad are talking to me again. I get a little job. You know, I get these things going on in my life and I'm like, I've recovered. And I really believe that. And I'm running around Alcoholics Anonymous like a nut trying to help everybody. And you're telling me what a great job I'm doing. And yeah, Jim, you're really... And you know what? It's all a lie I'm living. And, you know, eventually, probably after about 8 years, I had gotten this great external life of a million things. And I got like 18 inches of stuff on this 12-inch plate. And stuff starts falling off. Because I can't do it all. Because I'm out there trying to do so much that I have no centeredness in my life. I have no balance in my life. I'm running around. I'm running around just like when I drink and drug, except I'm not drinking and drugging. I'm just doing it in other areas of my life. I'm coaching kids' sports. I'm playing basketball. I'm working 12 hours a day. I'm in this relationship that I'm really not in. I got this mortgage on. I have a million things going on. And they're all starting to fall off the plate. And one of the things that fell off the plate was even going to Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, not doing what I need to be doing, I start to drift off to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I begin to go from 5 or 6 meetings a week to 3 meetings a week to 2 meetings a week to maybe trying to be of service, to get calling people up, hey, can you go make that pot of coffee for me tonight? And next thing you know, I've created a bigger problem with AA than I have with my drinking. And if you want to talk about a real bad place to be, talk about finding a way to have a bigger problem with the thing that will save your life than the thing that's killing you. And I had that. And I had a supermarket down the street from my house. I swear it was an AA supermarket. I don't care what anybody tells me. Every time I went in there, it was at least 8 or 10 people from AA. And I'd go in, and I'm not even drinking. And I'd go in, and I'd see them. Whew, I'd take off. I'd be running through the supermarket, not trying to run into these people. I'm not even drinking or drugging. But I'm running. It's like they got this radar. They know I'm there. And they run into me, and they ask me those two questions I absolutely have to lie about. How you doing and where you been? And I'm like, I'm doing fine, and I've been busy. And then they would say that third thing that would make me want to punch them. They'd look me right in the face and they'd say, give me a call, I'll take you to a meeting. Oh, used to just like cringe me. Used to walk away, and I'd have that conversation going on that I'm not in on the right shoulder going, you really should call them and get to a meeting. And the other shoulder's going, you don't need those damn people. You could show AA, you could do this without them. And I'm gone. I'm not even drinking or drugging. I'm gone. You know? And eventually, I'm in a position where one or two things are going to happen. I'm either going to drink because I can't take the pain anymore of me being in my own skin and what's going on. Or I'm going to blow my head off because not being here is a wonderful solution to having to go through this every day. And I'm just not built for, like, blowing my head off, so I choose to suffer. Because I'm not going back to AA because I got this pride and ego that won't allow me to walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and raise my hand and say, my name's Jim and I'm an alcoholic and my life is the worst it's ever been. Even without picking up a drink or a drug for 8, 9, 10 years. My ego will not let me do it. So those planets align and I drink. And I experience the same pattern of going back to jail. And I get in that jail cell and I'm experiencing that thing called the gift of desperation. I'm stripped naked of everything. I write a letter to Mom. I get the letter back from Mom that I never expected. Let me know. Not my problem. Go take care of it. After you take care of it, then get in touch with me. I got no girlfriends to get in touch with. I have no friends because all I do is hang out with associates that do what I do, and they ain't trying to hear me while I'm in jail. And I'm in that jail for about 28 days, and they let me go to my first AA meeting in jail. And I walk down to that meeting, and I walk in that meeting. And up at the front of the room, there's a guy that's chairing a meeting, and he's looking down, and I notice the guy. And it's a guy I used to sponsor. And you want to talk about some humiliation. And I tried, even without any donuts or coffee in my pocket, I tried to turn around and get out that jail gate, believe me, because I did not want to face him. And I couldn't get out because they don't let you leave once you're there. Matter of fact, the guard pointed, I was like, I know, been there, done this already, right? And I turn around, and he's looking at me now, and he starts to walk towards me. And this is the conversation I had in my mind. He's going to come over here and tell me what a jerk I am. He's going to ask me why I hurt my children and my family again. He's going to tell me what a loser I am. This is what I'm saying while he's walking over to me. And he gets to me, and he puts his arms out, and he hugs me. And he whispered the words in my ears that changed my life. And he said to me, I'm really glad to see that God has decided to sit you down and have another talk with you. And I was blown away. Because he did what Alcoholics Anonymous asked us to do in this program, and that's he shared his hope with me. He touched my heart. As calloused as it was, as hopeless as it was, he shared his experience in a perspective which touched my heart just enough to allow my thinking to be a little different. Because that night when I went to my cell, I laid in that bunk, and for the first time, I didn't feel as though what was happening to me. I felt it was happening for me. I really believed to a degree that I was in that jail cell experiencing the beginning of the miracle. Because the beginning of the miracle is not always pleasurable. Sometimes the beginning of a miracle can be confusing, unsure, stripped naked of everything, nobody talking to me, you know. Puts me in a position where I have to have conversations with something other than me that is not tangible, and I need to show some signs of blind faith with. I need to start having conversations with something that, you know what, are not human. And the conversations can be begging. The conversations can be however. It's the fact that I'm having the conversations. Because it's much different than what I was doing before I got in that jail cell. Because before I got in the jail cell, it was all about me. Now I'm willing to entertain that maybe it isn't all about me. Maybe there's something out there that's greater than me. Because I've come to the gifts of desperation and the understanding that I ain't doing such a good job with me. As a matter of fact, I'm treating myself pretty bad. I always say, nobody will ever lie to me as good as I lied to myself. Nobody will ever cheat me as good as I cheated myself. And nobody will ever con me as well as I con myself. And the key word is self. I keep depending on self. I keep relying upon self. And self doesn't take me anywhere. You know, I had a sponsor early on that told me, Jim, you have no business up in Disneyland without supervision. The rides are too big up there for you. You're the guy that walks up to the clown and is clearly a couple inches too short, and you tell yourself, I'm getting on that ride. I can handle it. And then you're screaming while you're on that ride to get off, and you can't. That's me to say with self. So, you know, God has definitely done for me what I couldn't do for myself. You know, He took me out of that jail and sent me to a rehab up in above Scranton, Pennsylvania. And it's pretty much hand-delivered me from person to person that has created that language of the heart and got me to really understand what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was about. See, there was two things that really happened. One is I had the gift of desperation, and there was a degree of willingness there. And the willingness was pretty much fueled by fear in the beginning, because I didn't want to go to jail forever and I didn't want to die. And I really knew that Alcoholics Anonymous did work, because even though for that previous time I was in here and I was doing the wrong thing, I watched a lot of other people's lives get better. I could not ignore that experience. I could not ignore the experience that people were changing in AA, and even though I picked up a drink, they weren't drinking, and things were happening in their life, and they talked about God, and I seen how God was. I couldn't ignore that. So I knew AA really did work. And I think once I became willing to take a look that AA really did work, and that, you know, I was starting to think a little bit different than I was ever thinking, and that I really had to take a look at what I was doing in AA the first time I was in it, I was able, you know, they say when the student is ready to teach your peers, and I really believe God put the person in my life that needed to be in my life at that time. Because I was 12-step by an experienced member, a lady in Alcoholics Anonymous, who really sat me down and shared through her experience what that first step of Alcoholics Anonymous was really about. Really about what qualifies me as being the real alcoholic in the book. You know? About having the allergy of alcoholism. I put alcohol to my lips and it masters me. You know, I tell myself that lie. I think I have control over something that's really controlling me. And that once I take that drink and I have that physical craving and mental obsession, to no degree can I tell you when I'm going to start or when I'm going to stop. I never stay within the lines that in my mind I tell myself I'm going to stay in. It never turns out how I plan it to. Never. So I'm the real alcoholic, and my sponsor was big in that first step on that unmanageability, and not the external unmanageability, but that internal unmanageability I talked about was that emotional unmanageability, that mental unmanageability, certainly that spiritual disconnection. And my sponsor was able to get me through those first couple chapters of the book, and really, for me, the thing that really made the difference in my experience was in We the Agnostics when I talked about that prejudice and that judgment. How I just have this predisposition thinking and this contemptuous thinking about what works in the world versus what I think works in the world for me. And the reason why I have that is because it's so tuned into my selfishness. My prejudice and my judgment is so tuned to my selfishness. Because I become terminally unique. And while I sit amongst you and I know I'm in the right place, I still in my own mind can create this indifference between me and you to where I can't connect to you. And if I can't connect to you, I can't stay stopped. Because it's through you that I get my relationship and the principles and the work of these steps that I get my relationship with this power greater than myself. See, I need to see in you that God works in your life because it automatically comes to me. And then I do this work and I reflect through sponsorship in this work of everything that's blocking me from this experience. You know, so I get into that first step and I take the first step and I get into that second step. And, you know, I begin to trust the collective wisdom of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a power greater than me. I am too scared to put the steering wheel back in my hands. I'll be honest with you. That's where I'm at right now, where I was at with step two back then. All I know is I was going to become more reliant that I stood a better chance of coming here and humbling myself and letting your experience and your collective wisdom guide me than for me to put my hands on that wheel again and crash the car one more time. Just didn't want to do it, man. Because I didn't think I'd make it back, to be honest with you. I really perceived if I crashed the car one more time, it would be death or forever in jail. And that was a motivator for me. And I get with the sponsor, and we kneel down and take this third step, and we get up, and I look at my sponsor, and she's smiling, and I go, "Why are you smiling?" And she goes, "Well, I just want to let you know that, you know, your belief in this higher power is no greater now than it was before you got on your knees." I said, "Well, why did we do it?" She said, "Because you just took the deal. You gave yourself permission." So what are you talking about? So we got a little further in the book. That I just gave myself permission to launch into a course of vigorous action. We need to get down to causes and conditions. We need to take a look at what's on your shelves of your business. Why you keep going bankrupt? And we need to do it right away, because if we don't do it right away, it has little to no permanent effect, which is the difference between stopping and staying stopped. See, I needed someone to show me that. I cannot read that book and self-teach myself that. That's why the book is a text and not a novel. I need the other person on the end educated, give me the experience through the educational variety to myself. And putting it away in the language of the heart where I can connect my experience to their experience to match up to the literature in the book. So I get into this thing called the fourth step. And I'm willing. And I'm writing it all down because it's coming out now. It's just coming. And, you know, I was one of those guys that wanted to write a novel. And my sponsor was real simple. Do it the way it says in the book. We only need a couple words in each column. We'll expand on it in the fifth step. It's where we'll spend most of our time. And I did that. And we got into that fifth step. And, you know, for the first time, I actually opened my soul to another human being without any prejudice, without any judgment, and without any secrets. And I walked away from that fifth step, and I lost my two best friends that I never knew I hung out with all the time. One was the great I, and the other one was the poor me. I no longer was a legend, and I no longer blamed anybody for my actions. I was freed from that. And I was able to see these defects of character I had. So in 6 and 7, you know, I'm identifying them and I'm asking God to remove them. And my sponsor tells me, you know, Jim, God will only remove what you're willing to let go of. And sometimes you need to continuously ask on a daily basis to continuously let go. And you're going to want to hold on to them because in your mind, to a degree, you're going to perceive that they still work. Especially when you experience feelings that you have a hard time experiencing. One of them is fear. Fear used to immobilize me. I was in an inpatient rehab one time, and I got a letter from the court system. My counselor handed it to me, and I took the letter, and I seen where it was from, and my counselor put her hand on my shoulder and said, "Jim, breathe." I had no idea that when I experienced great moments of fear, I actually stopped breathing. No idea. And I had to learn that about myself with my fear. You know? And we need to talk about that in the steps, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And I need to ask God to make me okay with that stuff and to take away. And And my sponsor was real good about taking my hand and bringing me along. Understanding what it's like to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor told me the importance of being a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous and the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and everything that has to do with what I'm doing when I take up a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I need to get to a point where it's not about what I take from AA, it's about what I bring to AA. And I can't bring anything good if I don't clear away this bad stock off the shelf and begin to practice some action of giving the best I can give with another individual. And the big thing it really did was it began to address my critical self. See, I have this critical self that was so kind of like the woman we were listening to the CD up talked about it too. I have this voice in me that if I let it and I don't work these steps, just like criticizes everything about me, just like the whys and how comes and everything. And I can complicate a free lunch with it, basically. And, you know, I need to let go of that critical self. That's another freedom I need because that allows me to transmit what Alcoholics Anonymous is about in my life. So we get into step 8, and, you know, my dad was the big one, really the big one in step 8. He was on my amends list. And it took me 8 years to get all my amends done. The last couple of years were basically financial amends because I made payment plans with people. But as far as the physical and direct amends with people, I had gotten them done in about 2.5-3 years, and my dad was the last one, and there was a major fear attached to that one because I knew the history of when I would interact with my dad, how he would seem to have so much power that I would do things with him that I knew I shouldn't do. And my sponsor, you know, kept saying, you know, Jim, this is the one that's not going to allow you to be really free. And, you know, I was in debate, and I got a phone call from my mom on a Saturday, and she said, you know, I feel obligated to tell you this. What you decide to do, I'm okay with us supporting you in any way, but your father has about a week to live. I'm like, ugh. She goes, if you want to go down and see him, I'll take you. If you want me to go with you, whatever you want to do. I do what I've been taught to do, and that's to trust the collective wisdom of AA. And I say, let me call you back, Mom. I need to call a couple people. I call my sponsor. I call a couple other people, experienced members of AA. I kind of ran it by them. And the collective wisdom all came up with this kind of state thing that I need to take my mom. I should probably take my sponsor. We should go down for a lot of period of time, maybe an hour or two. I should figure out what I want to say to him to put closure on this because I don't want to walk around in life later on going, I wish I would have. But my sponsor was clear and said, Jim, you do not go down there while he's on his deathbed and selfishly make your amends. It ain't about you. But you do need to go down there and say something to him as his son. So I called my mom and said we would be down on Monday. Sunday, I got a call. He passed away. I didn't get a chance to really go talk to him face to face. But the reality is I really only wanted to tell him one thing. I just wanted to look my father in the eyes before he went to his death, before he went to his casket and said, Dad, I just want you to know I understand. I want you to know that I forgive you and that, you know, don't go to your casket guilty and shameful and remorseful. I understand why things turned out like they did. I understand you suffer from untreated alcoholism. And when you have untreated alcoholism, you can't possibly suit up and show up for life. You're going to run around every day with the bottle not being deep enough, trying to cover up that guilt, shame, and remorse, and it never covers it up. And why do I know that, Dad? I know that because the thing I swore I would never do, which was be like you, when I had untreated alcoholism, it seemed like I was more like you every day. And I couldn't for the life of me figure out why. And it wasn't that I was like you, Dad, in that kind of a way. It was like our untreated alcoholism was the same, and it made us seem very similar. Because I had the same experience with my children that my father had with me. With my untreated alcoholism, I couldn't show up for my children. I was so guilty and ashamed. The bottle was never, I couldn't pour enough alcohol in it to make it go away. This program has made me free. I'm allowed to have relationships with my children today, which is very nice. My middle daughter actually came to me. She had a problem and asked if I would help her. You know, just what a change in role. You know, that's only something God could provide. You know? So, you know, here I am today, 14 plus years. I do a 10-step every day to the best of my ability that I can do. And that 11-step is really huge because, you know, one day me and Jeff were kind of hanging out. We were talking about prayer, and we were like, well, could you please look up the meaning of prayer? So, but Jeff has his phone that has all the answers in case you didn't. If you're looking for an answer, go to Jeff. He has a phone with all the answers. And he gets into the phone, and we look up prayer, and it says, the admittance of weakness. I'm like, oh, my God. Of course I need to pray every day. I need to pray every day because that's my admittance of powerlessness. That's me not thinking that I got this. I mean, I need to wake up every day and humbly go to God and say, God, I need your help. Please don't let me set on the course of life today thinking I got this or that I have this great director or control role where stuff's just going to be exactly the way I want it today. Because when I do that, guess what? Whew, that's the tough days. But when I'm able to get up and I'm able to get into prayer and then I'm able to sit still, this thing called meditation happens where I identify that fundamental idea of God inside me because I hear the voice. The voice talks to me. It really does. The voice says, you know, it's a good idea, Jim. It might say, no, you shouldn't do this. You should probably go do that. I hear it clearly. This was a voice I never knew existed, or if it did, I wasn't hearing it. And it allows me to do something, which is to get in the 12th step, which is when I get an opportunity like this, I'm able to stand before a microphone and talk to you about what it says on page 29 in our book, and that's share my experience of how this program has helped me to have a relationship with a higher power and why I need to be God-reliant every day and not human-reliant. And it also allows me to create the dynamic of one alcoholic helping another, because what happens is when I truly work that 12-step, it takes me right back into my first step. Whew. I need to do that. I don't want to be hanging on a 12-step without being able to get back into a first step. There's only one thing I experienced that was harder than working the steps. That was falling down. And I fell down the steps for it. And I know what it feels like to be dangling off that first step, holding on by fingernails, just trying hour by hour not to take a drink. But having no choice but to take it. I certainly don't live a life like that today. My life is very free. You know, I'm privileged to work in this field. God continues to provide me opportunity. I'll close with this. This is a situation that happened. I've been at the same job for about 8 years, and somebody called me out of the middle of the blue and said, you know, Jim, there's a brand new inpatient rehabilitation facility that's open in the Pocono Mountains, and we'd like to interview you to be the director of treatment. Okay, so I go down and I talk to them, and we really have a great interview. And they say, we'll get back to you. And I walk away, and a week later they get back to me, and they say, we want to bring you in for a second interview. And I come in, we go in for a second interview. And they tell me, no, they call me on the phone, and they say, well, we just want to let you know that it's between you and another guy. He has something that you don't have, which is 20 years of clinical experience. You have something that he doesn't have. You're in recovery. You have the passion. And you guys are like, we want you both. We don't know what to do. And he says, we'll call you when we make a decision. He goes, and the guy says to me this before he hangs up the phone. He says, Jim, I'm sure, because he's in recovery too. He says, Jim, I would put this in God's hands. Okay. So I hang up the phone. And I think I called Jeff and I told him, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to put this one in God's hands. Week goes by. 2 weeks goes by. I'm struggling. I want to make this call. I'm like, what's going on? I need to know. And like, all these scenarios are in my head. They hired this guy. They're not going to call me back. I mean, I had everything going on. I share it with Jeff. I go to Vegas for a week. I'm in Vegas. It's killing me while I'm in Vegas. Like, this whole process, right? And I would talk to Jeff, like, did you hear anything? And no, Jeff, I didn't hear anything. I go, it's tough keeping it in God's hands. I want to make this call so bad you don't even know. Jeff said, nah, you know, when you say you put it in God's hands, you know, your footwork needs to be that you put it in God's hands. So I come back from Vegas. I'm driving home from work one day. And my phone rings, and I look, and it's not a familiar number because like a month has gone by. I don't notice the number, and I answer the phone. It's the guy. He said, I want you to come in here and talk to me next week. I went in and talked to him. And they found a way to hire both of us guys that they wanted at the with everything that came with it. They found a way because they liked us so much. So I'm officially going to be starting that job in a couple weeks. And you know what? I walked away from that situation really understanding, when I talk about getting closer to God, really understanding about when I say I put it in God's hands, what that actually entails. Because that word God and the actions behind it roll off the lips so easy. But those physical thoughts and actions that come along with it are the difference between what my relationship with God is really like. Thank you guys very much.